Kashina and I met through her mom.
We were good friends for a while, and then we eventually started dating, and we got married in 2007.
So after we got married, then we decided that we needed to get new stuff. Got new furniture.
Decided to go get a new TV.
Tables.
We charged everything, even ridiculous things that we probably could afford, but it was just the fact of having the credit card that, you know, you could buy anything.
Shortly after we got married, I finished flight school. I found a job in Texas. We had big hopes that it was gonna be, you know, a good job. I mean, it had potential. It looked like it was going well. Toward the end of 2008, when the economy crashed, all of that work slowly started to disappear. And then eventually the company closed down.
We still tried to make it work, but when you have that much debt, it's very difficult to try to make anything like that work.
We ended up having to file bankruptcy and then, you know, start over. Our marriage was not doing great.
We were fighting all the time, and if anything happened, we were overreacting, because what we were really upset about was the fact that we had no money to do anything with. We had dug ourselves into this hole, and we only had each other to take it out on. Jerome actually got a job in Kansas, and I wasn't gonna go, because I felt like we had such a wedge between us.
Finances and the other problems we were having all at the same time caused us to, yeah, basically, we kind of separated while we were in, when I was in Kansas.
Marriage-wise, I was done. I did not want to be a part of this anymore.
It was definitely a painful time. Eventually, I was laid off from them as well, so no reason for me to stay in Kansas. I moved back here to Arizona, where my family is, and basically had to start over again. Maybe I kind of felt like I was failing, like I wanted to pick a career that would provide for my family, but up until this point, it just hadn't. Nothing was working. The more I tried to fix them, it seemed almost like it was just making it worse. At that point, I just decided I was gonna go all in to the church. I decided I was going to tithe 10% no matter what I made. And at that time I was only making $9 an hour just moving cars around a parking lot, but 10% gave it back. I had kind of decided I was gonna keep praying and keep tithing and just kind of sit back and just let God work.
I started going to church again, and that was kind of the big turning point. There was a message that Mark Moore did, and it spoke directly to me, and it was basically like, there's nothing that God can't fix.
She just decided that she wanted to make it work.
God has had his hand in all of it, and it just took us a long time to figure out where it was. It's kind of hard to see when you're in the middle of it. You know, now we've definitely hit a point where God has blessed our family tremendously.
What I've learned throughout this whole journey is that I can trust in God to do things. I don't need to control it all. And no matter how bad things got, I was able to just trust him. I actually just recently got hired at the job that I've been trying to get ever since I started going to school. You know, I work as a EMS helicopter pilot. I actually make more than we need each month, and we actually decided to start giving more. At this point, we're still working on our debt, but the confidence is there that we know we'll be able to take care of it.
And really, if you put God first in all aspects of your life, your marriage, your finances, everything, you will be shocked at how it works out.
The Clements turnaround story could become your turnaround story. And so many relationships are fractured because of finances. And in fact, you may be surprised to learn that the number one cause of divorce is not infidelity, but it's actually financial conflict. It's the tension that comes and the financial conflict and stress from the handling of money. But this series is significant regardless of your marital status, because what we do with the money we make has ramifications for our emotional health, for our friendships, for our family, for our retirement, for our everyday life. And I don't know about you, but I've learned so much these first 2 weeks of this 100 series. And Ashley's done a great job talking about giving and talking about savings. Now, I do need to tell you that this past week, I did end up doing a lot of counseling for several different CCV parents who fear being kicked out of the church. It seems that they were out at a restaurant, and evidently Ashley was there, and they think that he may have witnessed one of their kids ordering a Coke. It wasn't free drinks. It wasn't kids drink free that night. And they think that's what happened. And I'm telling you what, they are terrified that they're going to be excommunicated from CCV. Now, I'm joking about that, but when Ashley said that, I mean, I laughed out loud for a very good reason, because that's exactly how we raised our kids. And we'd get ready to go into a restaurant, and we'd all say, okay, we're making a pact. Water, everybody, water, all right? Okay, Dad, all right. And we were frugal, and I grew up in a very frugal home. My parents were extremely thrifty. They used to send us down to KFC to lick other people's fingers. Yeah. So that's frugal, all right? Already in this series, here's what we've learned, and here's what we're going to learn today. And you already know this. The Bible commands tithing. It encourages saving, and it discourages debt. And if you put those lessons into practice, it will become a financially fulfilling formula. So here's what the equation looks like. Giving 10% first fruits to the Lord, plus saving 10%, plus spending or living off of 80% equals financial freedom. Or you can put financial peace, because either one of those fit. And it's a healthy pattern. Giving the first fruits to the Lord, the first 10%, and then saving and setting aside another 10% for emergencies and for the future. And then living on 80% of what's left. The problem is that Americans, we tend to keep accumulating debt because we think the more we have, the happier we'll be. Now, you probably have noticed that I'm wearing a backpack today. And I don't think this will probably become a trend and catch on in theological circles. But I'm wearing a backpack for a reason. This represents something. This represents my personal debt. And I already, what you don't know is I already have 20 pounds of weight in this backpack. And we as a culture are in the habit of just adding things on. And periodically throughout this sermon, Nancy is going to pop up and she's going to add more weight. And she's going to put more and more weight, in here. And the reason that's significant is because it mirrors what we do as a culture and as individuals, where we just keep adding, and we just keep adding it on. Now, I want to be upfront with you. I am not a bodybuilder. No, I'm serious. I am not, all right? So this is very unnatural for me. I don't go hiking, you know, like you all do and all these things. But debts do what weights will do. And gradually they take their toll. Now, we want to be accurate in what the Bible says about debt. So let's make certain that we're truthful. The fact that the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks about there are some cases where people should loan money to others, lets us know that it is okay to borrow money. So think of it like this. So according to the Bible, debt is not a sin, but it is risky because it enslaves you and it weighs you down. And I mean it weighs you down. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 7. You probably know this verse. The borrower is a slave to the lender. You are held hostage by the lender or the loan until your debt is paid. It infringes upon your freedom. With this burdensome backpack on, I have less spring in my step. I have less joy in my life. And over time, we grow accustomed to carrying around a large amount of financial weight that we really weren't created to carry. And some of you understand exactly what I'm talking about through this analogy. But we tell ourselves, well, you know, we're not alone. I mean, 8 out of every 10 American people live paycheck to paycheck. And that's true. And somehow we find peace in knowing that there are plenty of others who are in a similar setting. It's as if misery loves company. But I'm telling you, debt drains. Debt suffocates. Debt can kill a generous spirit. It can deplete a thriving marriage. Debt can bring worry for today and fear for tomorrow. But you need not perpetually stay in debt. And today I want us to take a look at a very obscure and perhaps unfamiliar passage of Scripture. It's found in the Old Testament in Deuteronomy chapter 15. And we're going to look at a concept in just the opening verses of this passage. And this is what it says. It says, at the end of every 7 years, you must cancel debts. This is how it is to be done. Every creditor shall cancel any loan they have made to a fellow Israelite. They shall not require payment from anyone among their own people, because the Lord's time for canceling debts has been proclaimed. So let me tell you what's going on here. Deuteronomy 15 tells us that in ancient Israel, all debts with fellow Jews were to be canceled after 7 years, totally forgiven. That was the longest term. There weren't 30-year notes or 20-year or 15-year or 10-year. 7 years was the longest period of time. And here's what they were thinking. They were thinking, if you couldn't pay the debt off within those 7 years, then you had enough integrity not to enter into the agreement. I mean, in 7 years, if you weren't certain that you would be able to pay it off in that time, then you didn't do the deal. You didn't enter into the agreement. So this 7-year plan was a civil command for the nation of Israel, but it was a Jewish custom that I think we can still learn from today when it comes to debt. What if you chose to work hard and diligently discipline yourself to be out of debt 7 years from now? Or you can choose to just keep adding more and more weight on and more debt and watch your backpack weigh you down. Did you watch the Winter Olympics? Put your hands up at every campus if you watch some of the Winter Olympics. Oh, it's fun to see. I think my favorite thing is seeing that steep hill, terrifying steep hill, and you see these young people flying down there, going crazy, going down so quickly, and it just reminded me as I was watching it of an old quote from a financial guru. His name is Ron Blue. This is what he used to say. He said, getting into debt is as easy as getting down an ice-covered mountain, but getting out of debt is just as difficult as climbing back up that same mountain. So how can we stop the weight from increasing? Because what starts out as being bearable starts to affect every aspect of your life. And in your mind, it consumes your thoughts, and it is the center of marital arguments. Approximately 82% of you who are listening to my voice right now, you have some type of debt. It might be large, it might be small, but you are a slave to a lender. So I'm going to give you 4 very clear steps that can help you eliminate debt and experience freedom. Number 1, choose to be generous. Now, some of you are thinking, well, now, wait a second. Well, how does giving money away help eliminate my debt? Well, I know it seems counterintuitive, but when we honor God with what he already deserves, or what really belongs to him, when we honor God with what he has blessed us with, we are acknowledging his lordship. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 9. Honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of your crop. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing, and your vats will brim over with new wine. So when we give the first part of our income, when we make God the priority, hello. I liked her before we started the service. We acknowledge his lordship, and all seeing God notices this. It is a demonstration of our dependence on the divine. For nearly 30 years at the church where I serve, we had a man on staff. He was a stewardship pastor. And Mike met with all sorts of individuals and with couples who attended our church and who lived in the Louisville area. And some of them just visited our church. Some of them just had some type of financial problem. But he did this all day long, and he did it for nearly 30 years. And he helped them with planning budgets and digging out of overwhelming debts. But Mike told me toward the end of his ministry, he told me that the telling takeaway that he had discovered through his ministry was this. In meeting with nearly 5,000 people over the course of his ministry, there had only been 4 of them who, when they first came in to meet with Mike, who were currently tithing. 4 out of 5,000. You know, it seems if you ask God to help you in a certain area, it's wise to honor him in that same area and to put him first. And fortunately for many of those people, that's what they did. Obedience is God's love language. And 90% with God will always go farther than 100% on your own. So be generous. Here's step 2. Assess your situation. Assess your situation. How much do you make? What are your expenses? Now, on the surface, it sounds like this is a very easy step, but I'm telling you, it's painful. And for those of you who are married, you're well aware that one of the two of you understands your financial situation a whole lot better than the other one does. And you may know that it's more dire than you let on to your spouse because it's a lot easier to just avoid the topic altogether, and it's easier to drift than it is to swim against the current. Thank you, hon. I really appreciate it. And like an ostrich that sticks his head in the sand, we don't want to know just how bad our situation is. We prefer ignorance to honesty. Proverbs 27, verse 23 and 24 says, "Be sure that you know the condition of your flocks. Give careful attention to your herds, for riches do not endure forever, and a crown is not secure for all generations." So be informed and be involved. Pay attention to interest rates and how you could pick up some extra income or cut out some expenses. This is really heavy. And they put more weight in today than they did yesterday. But it's not as heavy as what some of you are feeling as I'm talking about this subject. You know, studies reveal that ladies tend to buy more things than men do. Yeah. Feel sorry for that guy later. Funeral will be held on Thursday here at the... Women tend to buy more things than men do. Men tend to buy bigger and more expensive things than women do, all right? Yeah. All of a sudden, this guy's good. Yeah, all right. But it's true. And whether you're single or you're married, decide that you are going to spend less money than you make. You say, oh, wow, that's very profound, Dave. Spend less money than you make. Oh, thank you, Captain Obvious, right? Well, I say that to you because 54% of Americans admit that they spend more than they make. On average, Americans spend somewhere between 106 and 107% of what they make. You say, well, Dave, that's impossible. That statistic doesn't make sense. Of course it doesn't make sense. Spending more than you make defies logic. But here in America, it has become the norm. In fact, this backpack keeps getting heavier because it represents our behavior and our habits. Fortune magazine had a headline last month: credit card debt is higher than it has ever been nationally. You see, last year it surpassed the previous record year of 2008. You see, some 60 years ago, there was something that came out, an invention, a small little plastic thin card. And you can insert it, you can swipe it, you could make an imprint of it. Now you just, on your mobile device, just tap a few numbers and you can have the same benefit of what a credit card does. And it will postpone your problems while giving you what you want immediately. The average credit card debt for a U.S. household is $5,700 a month. Now, there is nothing wrong with having a credit card, as long as you're in the discipline of paying it off completely each month. But that $5,700 figure that is the national average includes all of us who pay our credit card bills off each month. You say, well, what's the significance of that? Well, if you take that group of people out who pay off their credit cards every month, and you now do a new average for those who carry a balance small or large onto the next month, do you know what the average monthly credit card bill is? $16,048. And that is staggering. And it robs you of your joy. And for the teens who are here and listening, you might think, oh, this message doesn't apply to me. Why am I here? Well, let me tell you something. When you turn 18, you're going to get more mail than you ever dreamed of. And they will give you all sorts of opportunities. You'll be flooded with mail from credit card companies, and they will be throwing credit cards at you. And it will seem harmless, and it will be so convenient. Beware. I wrote down a summary on your note page of what's happening in our society. My friend Barry Cameron explains it this way. He says, we spend money that we don't have on things that we don't need to impress people that we don't even like. Mortgaging a future we won't be able to enjoy because of a past that we'd like to forget. What an apt description of a society that feels entitled and is impatient. And if you're married, let's understand that if one of you curtails their spending, well, that's a start, but it takes two. It's kind of like it is with parenting. When it comes to consistently disciplining your children to get the desired end result, it depends upon the resolve of the weaker of the two parents. And the same is true if you're married when it comes to eliminating debt. You both have to be unified in going after the goal and changing your spending habits. Well, here's step three. Develop a budget and stick with it. Ashley talked about having an emergency fund. So maybe the first thing you need to do is to establish a $1,000 emergency fund. And you'll need to evaluate just how much it is that you need to have in there. But you decide that. But start with that, and then you need to go after this stuff with a plan. Find out how much you make. Find out what your absolute necessities are. Which debt it is that you want to attack first. I get excited at this point in the message because now this is when my able assistant, Nancy, is going to switch roles. And she's going to start removing weights instead of adding them. Because that's what will happen when you live by a budget. And this really does become the fun part. The budget part isn't fun, but what's fun is when you start to see the progress. And there's this reversal of the directions, and that's when it feels great. John Maxwell says it like this. He says, a budget is simply telling your money where to go instead of wondering where it went. And there are a wide variety of apps that you can get and programs to keep track of where your money is going. There's one that's called the Every Dollar app, and it's free. And you can get that on your phone, and you can determine your line items on your budget, and you can just stay the course and kind of keep track by line how you're doing. And your lifestyle is going to have to change if you want this debt situation to change. And a budget provides guardrails. If it's not in your budget, you refrain from making a rash or reckless purchase that you're going to regret. Debt is the result of giving ourselves what God hasn't given us yet. We just weren't patient enough to wait. We don't do a real good job of waiting. Early on in our marriage, late one night, there was something going on with one of our kids, and my wife, Beth, said, hey, can you go to Kroger for me? Kroger's a grocery store that we have, a chain of them in Kentucky. And she gave me a list of four items. And, well, I'd never really gone to Kroger by myself. I'd always gone with her. It was late at night. I went in there, and I mean, it was having fun, you know? I was wandering around. I started seeing things I'd never seen before. I was in places I'd never been before in Kroger. And I saw chocolate things. And I got so excited, and I just started putting stuff in the cart. And I would be at the end of an aisle, and they would have all these sales going on there. And I'm like, oh, well, I can save us some money. And I was picking up different things. I went past the display, and they had bacon. And they had it on sale if you had your Kroger card with you. I came up to the front by the counter. They had a display. If you got 4 2-liters of Coke, you got two of them free. Well, who can pass that up? I came home. I walked in the door. No lie, I had two huge grocery sacks with me. And she looked at me and she said, what in the world happened? And I said, baby, I saved us a lot of money. And I began to tell her about all the things and these special deals that I found at the ends of the aisles and all the things that were up at the counter. She said, don't you know they put all those things there because there are impulse buyers. I said, what's an impulse buyer? She said, you. And then she said, how much money did you spend? Sheepishly, I replied, $37. Now, you have to remember, this was over 20 years ago, and I was there to get four items, right? And I'll never forget, because when I said $37, that's when she lowered the boom, and she looked at me. She said, that's the last time I ever send you to the grocery store. She had fallen into my trap. Proverbs 21, verse 5. Plan carefully and you will have plenty. But if you act too quickly, you'll never have enough. Now, we all need help to keep our wants under control. I tell people that if you're single, it is healthy to have a close friend just to kind of hold you accountable with your spending. If you're married, determine between the two of you the highest amount that you can spend without getting spousal approval. Just make certain that both of you have the same amount, all right? Here's the fourth step. Attack old debts and avoid new debts. You see, debt is not a problem that will fix itself. If your game plan to get out of debt is winning the Arizona lottery, your game plan is to answer 12 questions right on HQ and to be able to put some money towards some debts, I think you probably need to rethink your strategy. If you aren't paying off your credit cards or significantly chipping away at your school bill, then at some point you have to get some wise counsel. You need to shock the system, because if you simply do nothing, your debt load will increase because of interest. Proverbs 13, verse 12 says, hope deferred makes the heart sick. That's what debt does. It defers hope. It saps today of its strength, and it robs the joy of tomorrow, because debt evaporates your discretionary money. And I know this is tough for some of you to hear, but you need to hear it. I love the fact that this church preaches the truth, and sometimes the truth isn't easy to hear. But I'm telling you what, if you absorb it, and if you pour it into your life, and if you pray and ask for God's help, He can do something special. Barry Cameron says, we need to change our mindset. When we see something we want and we reach for our credit card, we need to think of the four letters which spell the word debt. You know what we need to think of? Don't even buy that. That's what debt stands for from now on in your mind. Don't even buy that. Don't even think about it. Show some willpower. Avoid compounding your debt problem. Enact a spending and shopping freeze. It's so good to see you. How are you? Some financial experts say to pay off your smallest debt first. Others say choose the one that has the highest interest rate. It really doesn't matter. You just start and get some momentum. Just do something. Get a win under your belt. You know what's strange? Nancy has made three trips out to take a lot of weight out. And it wasn't until this third trip that I really felt like I felt something different. Because we just kind of get used to debt. And we grow accustomed to living under it. And that's how it is. You say, well, I'll never be able to eliminate all of it. Well, if you start nibbling a little at a time after a few months or after a year, you're saying, wow, I'm making a big dent. And you start to feel the difference. Look at that. If you're already a few years into a 30-year note, discipline yourself to make at least one or two extra payments a year. It makes a big difference. If you're about to buy a home, really consider getting a 15 or 20-year note rather than a 30-year note. I'll tell you why. You will save tens of thousands of dollars. There's so many things you can do if you're willing to make radical changes. And I promise you, if you do, in 7 years' time, you will be rewarded greatly. If you didn't hear Ashley's first message in this series, I want you to go back online and I want you to listen to that one on giving. And he shared some of his personal journey with us. And Ashley's been generous with his money. He's a very disciplined guy, if you know him. He's very disciplined. And he and Jamie were totally debt-free by the time they were 30. And I was motivated by his message because he has credibility. But his story isn't my story. Let me give you a peek into my own personal journey, and then you can decide if my advice is even worth listening to. I was blessed with very generous Christian parents who never had much, but they always gave cheerfully. I grew up in a home where my brother and I were raised to double tithe. It was a very joyful expression, and it came naturally for our parents, and it came naturally for us. And looking back, I just say, I was so fortunate to have parents like that. And my brother and I, we followed their pattern, and then we continue to grow in our giving, and we've never wavered from it. And God has always provided for us. In my 20s and 30s, I would tell you that I made a couple really wise financial choices that were countercultural, that saved us thousands of dollars in interest as a family. And our generosity to the Lord was growing, and our equity in our home at that time was growing too. And all the while, my backpack was getting lighter. But then when I was in my early 40s, I started investing in real estate, and I bought a rental property down in Florida. That was back at the time when you could buy a house or a condo by just putting 5% down or 10% down. And our first property that I bought doubled in value in the first 18 months. We sold it. We made a lot of money. We put every dollar of that money, all of that profit, into a more expensive property. And my wife thought I was a financial genius. She even withdrew my ban on late-night grocery shopping. Well, our church was in a capital campaign, and so we bought another place in Florida to flip and to give the profits to the church. And that worked out well for the church. And then again, we used our equity and we got another place. And this one was twice the value of our own home that we lived in. And it just seemed like such a wise and good investment and such wise stewardship. But then in 2008, the real estate bubble burst. And having mortgages that ballooned after 3 years that had worked so well in the past, I learned they don't work that well if you can't sell the place within 3 years. Because property values plummeted, and in a matter of months, everything changed. And I mean everything. And I now had one house with two mortgages, and I had two investment properties that were worth significantly less than the mortgage that I had on them. And no longer did I look like a genius to my wife. And as the man of the house and the provider of the family, I'm telling you, I felt like a monumental failure. And I would lay awake at night and my stomach would churn, and it was a feeling of hopelessness. I lost more than money. I lost sleep. I lost peace. I lost freedom because the borrower is a slave to the lender, always has been and always will be. Until this message, I've never shared this story publicly. But at the time, my personal indebtedness was five times my annual income. And while that is incredibly embarrassing to say out loud, I tell you it in hopes that some of you will find solace in my situation or discover the motivation in beginning to dig out of your own monetary mess. My decision to invest by taking on high percentages of debt carried with it huge implications, and that's awkward to admit. But my wife was so supportive, and my wife was so forgiving, and our teenage children were understanding. And as a family, we prayed more than we had ever prayed during that stretch, and we did without. And looking back at that difficult season, I think the wisest decision that we made was deciding not to reduce our giving to the Lord. And on paper, it would have appeared really ridiculous to a non-Christian. But we wanted the Lord to know he was still the priority of our lives despite our financial turmoil. And it's quite discouraging when you know that you're going to be digging out of a hole for 20 years. But not long after that, I preached a message on debt to my congregation, and I stumbled across that passage from Deuteronomy 15. I'd never been aware of it, about debts only going for 7 years. Back then. And so in my sermon, I challenged our entire congregation to really go after their debt, and I asked them to pray about it, and they could anonymously let us know their decision. The next week, 19% returned a card to the church saying that they would strive to become debt-free, except for their house mortgage, in the next 7 years. Another 16% indicated that they were going to try and be totally debt-free in 7 years for everything. House included. And as ludicrous as it sounds to you, my wife and I prayed, and we jumped in with that group and said, with the Lord's help, we'll try to be totally debt-free. And we diligently followed these four steps that we've talked about, and we prayed nightly for our investment properties to sell, but they didn't sell. And yet, through our tightening of the belt, in desperation, we learned a greater dependence on God, and he sustained us through unexpected income opportunities and through his own creativity. In 2 long years after we made that commitment, we sold the first rental property. And 3 years after that, we sold the second property. And 1 year after that, by the grace of God, last August, we made our last house payment, and we are completely debt-free. How does that happen? And I got this off of my back. And while others would have screamed, "We're debt free," instead we whispered to a faithful God. Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine. What we thought would take 20 years, God did in 6. And I'm telling you, with a plan and with generosity and with discipline and with prayer, my story can become your story. This weekend can become a defining moment for your family. I don't care how you got in your financial situation. There can be good reasons, there can be bad reasons. That doesn't matter. I don't care how you got in your financial situation. What matters is how are you going to get out of it? What are you going to do? And I've been praying this entire week of what will be your takeaway. So in that very first blank, that first little blank on your note page, I just want you to write a number in. I want you to write 225-25. 225-25. Just write that down. You see, today is 225. It's the 25th of the second month, and at every campus today, we're offering Rock Solid Finances. It's a free 2-hour class. You will learn so much. You'll see that you're not alone. And notice this, 7 years from now is 2025. So 225-25 is 7 years from today. I want you to fill the rest of that takeaway in. Because here's what I hope it'll be. I will take steps to become debt-free by 225-25. Maybe you do everything but the house. Maybe you go for it all. This is totally between you and God. I mean, it's just up to what God lays on your heart. You just pray about 2:25:25. But remember, nothing changes if nothing changes. Go to that Rock Solid Finances class at any campus today. Draw a line in the sand. Pray. Start taking the steps that can lead to freedom. Don't miss out on this moment in time. And I hope I can come back and join with you on 2:25:25 when we all can afford to buy a Coke. And we can celebrate our God who specializes in doing the impossible. Let's pray. Lord, in this series, you've challenged us to look at our giving and our saving and our spending. In your word, you tell us that when we have a faith in you, that you can move mountains. And Lord, I know that those who are listening to me right now, there are mountains of debt in this room. And today we surrender them all to you, along with our greed and our failures and our plans. And we claim victory through Jesus, the one who paid our biggest debt, our sin debt, when he died as a perfect sacrifice, wiping the slate clean for those who put their trust in him. It's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.